This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Record companies, record stores, even CDs have become irrelevant to a lot of music listeners who are relying on websites and digital listening devices for their music. To help make sense of what's going on in the digital music world and how it's affecting the music industry as we know it, we've invited Elliot Van Buskirk. He writes about digital media for Wired.com on his blog Listening Post. Elliot Van Buskirk, welcome to Fresh Air. A few years ago, Napster was the big thing, and people were exchanging music through Napster without paying anything to record companies or artists. The record industry sued. Napster is no longer free. But meanwhile, a lot of other systems have developed that are bypassing record companies. So let's look at a couple. Give us an example of one or two legal models for distributing music that bypass record companies.
Well, one of the most interesting ones going on right now is called record label if you just remove the vowels. So I don't know how to pronounce this, record label, something like that. But that's how it's spelled. And they basically, this site looks like a blog. It's a bunch of entries and you can download a song at the bottom of each entry. What's different is that they own those songs and all of it's free. So they'll go out to an artist and pay them anywhere from $500 to $5,000 per song. And for that, they get to offer that song for free. They get to put ads around it, whatever they want. And from a user's point of view, you know, you're on a website. It looks normal. It has ads on it. And you download a song and it's free. And you don't get sued. And everybody's happy and everybody gets paid. So that's kind of a nice model, I think.
Now, say a record really takes off. Is it a flat fee for the artist or do they get royalties?
It is a flat fee. And so that's something that's, you know, still being worked out. I bet the first time, you know, an artist sells, a million tracks or so, and for that $5,000, then that model could start changing.
Well, yeah, because it reminds me of in the early days of rock and roll when artists were given a flat fee and then they went on to be big stars and felt like they were completely ripped off.
Sure. I mean, it could be the Colonel all over again, you know, with Elvis. But that is really symptomatic of the type of rethink that the industry is going in. I mean, the fact that we're comparing something that's happening in 2008 to something that happened at the very beginning of the recorded music business, you know, that's sort of indicative of what a big transition this is.
Now, give us another example of a new distribution model that is legal but bypassing the record companies.
Okay, here's one that's legal and is somewhat bypassing the record companies. And it's generated a lot of controversy, called Q-Tracks. And basically what Q-Tracks is, it's the old Napster, but everything that you download gets wrapped in a sort of secure wrapper that then tells Q-Tracks how many times you listened to the song. And they take their ad revenue and divide up the money between the labels based on who listened to which song, how much, even down to how many seconds they played each song. So it's a very highly auditable system, which is another thing that the labels probably don't like, because auditing is not always their friend.
There's something called fan-funded music that is basically using listeners to give the money to make records. Why don't you give us an example of that model?
Oh, I love this. This is something we won't see in America due to, I think our laws call it gambling and running an illegal stock market. But, you know, on the surface of it, it's none of those things. Basically, fans get together and decide that they really like a band and they're each going to put in, say, $10 before an album is released. Now, once that amount gets up to, in one case, $30,000 and another $50,000, then the band goes into the studio, records the album, and all the fans who believed in them own a piece of that album. So they actually get a cut of subsequent revenues. This isn't just, you know, this sounds like a pipe dream or something, but one of these companies called Celeband has had 14 bands reach the $50,000 mark. And one of those, Slice the Pie, they just released their first ever album by a band called The Alps, and that was funded entirely by fans as well.
You said we're not going to see this model in the United States because it would be illegal. So are the two websites that you talked about, Celeband and Slice the Pie, not American-based?
Exactly. Celeband is in Holland and Slice the Pie is in England. And apparently, you know, you can actually buy and sell shares in these bands. You know, it's just like a little miniature stock market. And unfortunately, I think our authorities would call that an illegally unregulated stock market. And I assume that that will change because clearly it's not about gambling or running some kind of weird unregulated market. It's just about fans believing in bands and getting them financed when maybe the label would not pay to have that label that album made.
So the websites are based in other countries, but can Americans legally participate?
Yes, yes. This is one thing about online music that doesn't appear to be illegal yet.
Curious thing is there's so many bands now putting out their own music on websites or their own CDs with their own artwork. We used to rely on record company promotion and radio and MTV and VH1 to get the word out about new bands. They'd play the music, they'd show the videos, the record companies would promote the bands. So for all these like bands that are only represented on the internet, how are you supposed to find out about them?
You know, this is the problem. There are, I think, 7 million bands on MySpace right now. And, you know, I bet they're under a million are probably anybody would consider even slightly listenable, you know. So what the labels have always done is something that's very important and continues to be important, which is find new bands, new acts, new talent, and most importantly, develop them, help them actually grow the way the industry used to work. You know, in the 70s, you saw artists, you know, they'd get to put out 4 or 5 albums without any of them being a hit while they developed. And today's system could never generate somebody like Bruce Springsteen, you know, who wasn't an initial hit. And now, you know, he fills the Meadowlands every time he plays and everybody knows his name. So I think something is going to have to continue that role of finding new bands and taking them to that proverbial next level, as much as that expression is overused. But to put them past MySpace, take them out of this 7 million band quagmire and elevate them in front of a larger audience. And that's what's really exciting right now is there isn't really a great mechanism for that, but, you know, that's an opportunity.
So there are emerging legal models of making sure that artists are paid while still bypassing record companies. There's new models of paying royalties and bypassing record companies. Let's look at a couple of those models. One of them is a website called TuneCore, and another's called CD Baby. Tell us a little bit about these two different models.
This is tremendously exciting to me. I mean, when I first started covering digital music in, I guess, 97 or 98, you know, one of the big promises was that the internet is such a vastly efficient way to deliver music. If you think about trucks full of CDs consuming gasoline going all across the country, suddenly being replaced by nearly free digital distribution, that's pretty exciting. And, you know, a lot of us were excited to see the price of music drop and the amount of music that people consume increase because this is such an incredibly efficient way to distribute notes, literally. And oddly enough, we have not seen the price of music drop significantly as a result of distribution getting so much cheaper. Now, what's so exciting about TuneCore is they charged Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails something like $38 to deliver his 36-song album to Amazon MP3 for a year. And that's a flat fee. It doesn't matter how many copies he sells. And this is where we're starting to see, finally, the digital music movement split away from how the CD used to be. So it's tremendously exciting that somebody is I guess the metaphor I like is that the middleman is not eating and now he's tightening his belt. And TuneCore is an example of that.
Okay, wait. So Trent Reznor pays TuneCore $38 so that they will distribute his CD. So what does he get for that $38?
Sorry. Well, it's just he just gets his digital files prepped into the right formats for the Amazon MP3 store and actually delivered to them. They're starting to set up these pipes so that you just talk to TuneCore. You spend really a nominal fee, and you know, this is no guarantee that iTunes is going to accept, you know, some type of horrible song just because somebody pays this fee. You know, that's the fee that gets you to the digital distributors such as iTunes or Amazon MP3, and then they take it from there. But obviously, you know, somebody like Trent Reznor, they're going to be excited to receive his album.
And what about royalties?
He keeps all royalties for this, 100%. And this is just a huge break from how things used to work in the past. I would caution, you know, this is all very exciting for a lot of us, but Trent Reznor is not the everyman, as it were. You know,
if you're a name brand and you try this, you don't need the same kind of promotion and advertising.
Right. I mean, the irony to me is that it's only the artists who the labels system has built up who are able to do this.
Right. That's a very good point. Now, there's another similar but different model called CD Baby. How does this website work?
They work similarly. I'm not as familiar with the exact terms of what they charge. But they do essentially the same thing. They do physical and digital distribution so that if you're a small artist or a small label, you know, you can just go to them and your stuff shows up everywhere. You know, if you're an intern at a major label right now, you spend a lot of your time just adding friends on MySpace, you know, literally clicking add. I know people who do this. You know, when you're a small operation, you can't afford to deal with every single website on the planet. So that's what's so cool about aggregators like this, like CD Baby, TuneCore, what IOTA does even, and they do digital distribution as well. You know, if you're a musician and you're a small operation, what you want to do is make music. This is why you are what you are. And you don't want to become an expert on Web 2.0 technologies and interface with business development vice presidents all day. You want to record music and play shows. So a lot of these small little companies are just taking one little element of what a record label used to do and just doing only that really well, so that as an artist, you can sort of pick and choose between these different services until you have something that somewhat resembles a label.
I think in the CD Baby model, the artist pays a setup fee and then the website keeps a percentage of the sales and pays the rest to the artist. So that's one model for distributing
Sure.
the money. Now, do you think the record companies are using all these music websites as a way to scout for talent? Like once a website proves that an artist has selling power, that then the record company moves in and does the old-fashioned thing with them. You know, puts out a CD, gives them marketing and, you know, promotion and production money.
This is absolutely true. In one case, that site Slice the Pie, one of their bands called Gill Kicker had reached its $30,000 mark at the point where it got to start making an album. And at that point, a label became interested because the label says, hey, they've got fans to raise $30,000 without a record. This record hasn't even come out yet. These guys have committed $30,000. So the label then knows that this band is worthwhile. And they actually bought those contracts out. So the people who had invested in the band made, I think, 150% on their investment just right off the bat when the label bought out that band. And another example of labels using websites to find new artists is actually kind of incredible. These same peer-to-peer companies that they, you know, every chance they get, they deride these networks, you know, like the original Napster or LimeWire or BitTorrent and stuff like that. But the labels actually pay a company called Big Champagne to monitor those peer-to-peer, you know, so-called illegal networks. And by monitoring those, they figure out which song to promote as the single from an upcoming album that's been leaked. I mean, they get all kinds of great data from this. And I'm sure that they look for unsigned bands that are getting a lot of traffic and try to sign them.
Okay, you use the expression peer-to-peer, also known as P2P. So what is that?
That's basically I open up a folder in my hard drive and everybody can download music from it and vice versa, you know, basically the way the original Napster worked. And what's great for the labels, you know.
And no money passes hands. I mean, there's no royalties or anything that's paid. It's just.
True, right. Exactly.
Which is why it's illegal.
Right.
Record industry people and bands from around the country have gathered in Austin, Texas for the South by Southwest Music and Media Conference. We're talking about how digital audio technology is changing the music world. My guest is Elliot Van Buskirk. He writes about digital media for Wired.com on his blog, Listening Post. Record companies are trying new models when they release new records, models that include the internet. And some of them are taking their cue from Radiohead, who had decided to first release their album digitally only through the internet, and listeners were supposed to decide how much they were willing to pay for it. And then Radiohead actually got a CD deal and did it the more old-fashioned way. So what are some of the bands that are trying models that are kind of taking off from the Radiohead approach?
Well, one thing that just about every label that approaches me, I do some degree of music reviewing in my job, and almost without fail, you can hear the entire album for free as a stream before it goes on sale. And that's usually just as a journalist, but in many cases, they're doing this for the public also. So, and this is straight out of the Radiohead playbook. You'll get a little, they're calling them e-postcards or widgets or whatever it's called. Basically, it's a little text box that people can put on their blogs or anywhere else on the internet. And you click that and you hear the entire album for free. Now, it's a stream. You can't download it and put it on your iPod or anything like that. But that's, you know, that's a huge leap from the label strategies of 10 or even 5 years ago, you know, when they were so fearful of somebody connecting some type of tape recorder up to their computers and recording this free so-called promotional stream. And now they've really opened up and realized that if people can't hear the music, they're not going to buy it.
It's hard to talk about digital music without mentioning things like iTunes or the subscription service Rhapsody. And what impact do you think that they're having on the record companies? How are they helping? How are they hurting the companies?
Well, iTunes just became the second largest music retailer in the country. Now, that counts stores, websites, anything. So this is a major force. This is not just, you know, for internet people or something. This is actually the second largest music retailer of any kind in the country. So it's not a niche.
The first being Walmart?
Yes, yes. I remember seeing a statistic at one point that 35% of music in the country was purchased at Walmart, which is kind of interesting.
It kind of is, because it's not the specialty people, obviously, who are going to Walmart to buy their
right.
buy their music.
You know what's funny to me? The number one selling album of last year was a Christmas album by Josh Groban, who I hadn't heard of previously to that, and I follow music professionally. I think that the most popular albums are not being purchased by people who really like music, which I think is really, really interesting right now.
So one of the controversies now surrounding iTunes is the fact that iTunes can only be downloaded onto iPods. You can't download iTunes songs onto other brands of MP3 players. Why is this controversial?
Well, imagine when the CD came out, if there were, you know, a bunch of different kinds, and there's, you know, Sony has its own record label, so if you want to play a Sony CD, you've got to buy a Sony CD player. And then on top of that, you're going to need an Iowa CD player for bands from some other band. And obviously, the CD never would have taken off if that were the case. And that's kind of the case with music. We've seen a lot of improvement. It's all about the labels. It's not Apple's decision to make those rules. It's the labels who insist on rules in order to give the music to Apple. Fortunately, the labels, to varying degrees, are experimenting with releasing music without DRM. And in fact,
DRM is digital rights management, and that's the kind of encryption that allows you to download only to a specific product.
Exactly. That's what makes the iTunes music only play on an iPod. There has been a little progress even within Apple. You can switch your iTunes to something called iTunes Plus, and then you're able to download music without this digital rights management protection. I don't know if this is fortunately for Apple or what, but those files are still in the AAC format, which don't play on a lot of non-iPod MP3 players. But I'm sure that's just a coincidence.
Do you think that this is on the verge of changing? Do you think there will be less encryption and more ability to download onto a variety of MP3 players?
Absolutely. I mean, when the labels put these walls up, they are really only punishing law-abiding music fans. If you're someone who purchases the music, you're the only person who's affected by these usage rules that can be very frustrating when you're upgrading a computer or trying to shop for a new device. It's just it's an inevitability. If they keep insisting on it, they will continue to see the sales plummet. And I think that, you know, they've certainly gotten the picture that you don't want to punish the percentage of music fans that is playing by the rules. And that's what this digital rights management did.
You know, as the models for distributing and purchasing music change, there's all kinds of new questions that come up about artists' royalties. And in fact, the Copyright Royalty Board started hearings last month, and they're going to determine what the publishing royalties should be now for CDs, for downloads, and for the first time they'll be looking at subscription music services, ringtones, and interactive webcasts. What are some of the issues that the board has to examine before coming up? Like, what are some of the more controversial issues at the heart of this?
Well, the big one right now, and this battle is between the publishers and I guess everybody else, you know, the labels and the and websites. But the big thing right now is, if I compose a song, am I owed a flat rate? And if so, what should that flat rate be? And this has always been the case. But now that the labels want to decrease the price of music, or they say they do, and they say that they can't do that if they have to pay songwriters a flat fee for every song. If you're paying the songwriter 12 cents and you're paying Apple 35 cents, that doesn't leave a lot of room to drop the price of a song on iTunes. The songwriters and the music publishers have kind of kept out of this whole battle for years and sort of had this tacit or actually an explicit agreement saying, you know, do whatever you want with ringtones, do whatever you want with music streams. Just keep track of what you're playing so that you can pay us once we figure out what a fair rate is. And now this sort of touchy-feely agreement has fallen apart, and everybody's packing up their lawyers and heading to Washington.
Because songwriters and publishers are afraid that their percentages are going to go down, and they don't want to see that happen.
Exactly, and they don't get to negotiate the price of anything, of music, without getting too into the detail, the boring details here. But if you're a songwriter or, you know, a publishing house, you just get this flat fee per song for a bunch of different reasons, and you have no say in the price that it's that the song is sold for. That's why they don't like a percentage, the idea of getting a percentage of these services, because they can't negotiate the price. They want a flat fee, and this you know, this is an impasse. This could last a while, and it's basically, you know, people think of the music industry as a monolithic thing. But it's got so many components and so many various interests vying with each other, so that now we're seeing the publishers and the labels who have been on the same side during previous royalty debates, now they're going after each other, which is fascinating just to watch these shifting alliances.
Elliot, does hip-hop have a different model that's developing around its kind of digital distribution approach than indie rock does?
Yeah, the mixtape has been a huge part of hip-hop culture and continues to be, you know, like an up-and-coming rapper grabbing some instrumental tracks, laying down some vocals on top of it, going around selling cassettes out of the back of a car. I mean, you know, multi-million dollar careers have been built in that way. And so with the online hip-hop, I'm seeing two things. I'm seeing the mixtape everywhere, like the digital version of the mixtape. That seems to be the hot commodity in online hip-hop. And the other thing we're seeing is social networks that are designed just for hip-hop. You know, there are a lot of, I think, the first generation of music sites, they try to do everything for everybody. And I guess any sort of subsection of the music scene, they want stuff that just applies to them. I mean, if you're super into folk music, why spend all your time looking at promotions for techno bands, you know? And I think this is going to be a huge trend. We saw everything collect in the middle with Friendster and MySpace and Facebook. I think the next phase is it's going to disseminate out to the sides, and we'll have social networks just for hip hop music and websites dedicated only to hip hop mixtapes. And that certainly is already happening.
What's your assessment of the role radio plays now in popularizing music?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, this goes back to what we were talking about with the Washington situation. The label's take is that radio no longer promotes the sale of music. You know, they used to sort of give radio a free pass in America, and radio stations could play music for free because, you know, the upshot of that would be that everybody would run out and buy the CD or the record. People aren't running out and buying the CD or the record anymore, and so now labels are trying to charge radio for the right to play music. This can only hurt radio. I mean, people already are tuning out and listening to their iPods and caching podcasts. And this would be like the least opportune moment to increase the pressure that's on radio stations if they're supposed to stick around and remain a viable promotional resource for music. I mean, I'm not too bullish on the future of music radio.
So how has your listening changed? Like how you listen to and what you listen to, how you find new music, how has that all of that changed since you started getting really into digital music?
Mm-hmm. Well, I vacillate. I go through phases where I listen to only stuff that I've collected, which is a lot, and then I get bored of that or I can't think what is it that I want to hear. So I find myself sort of vacillating between self-programming and letting somebody else do the programming for me, going to, say, Pandora or Last.fm and just keying in a favorite artist. And, you know, you can start listening to music and being surprised by new stuff in about 30 seconds by entering in just a single artist name.
And then so they give you people who you should like if you like that person.
Oh, they just play it. You enter the artist's name and then you sit there and then you listen as things that sound like that
mm-hmm.
play.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you can tag stuff. If you say, oh, well, that's good. I've never heard of that artist before. And you hit a little heart button and then that artist is more likely to play on your station. So I don't think programming is dead. I mean, radio might be hurting music-wise, but programming as a concept is just as valuable as ever. Just needs to be done in a new way. And that is what we're seeing with Pandora and Last.fm.
Well, Elliot Van Buskirk, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Elliot Van Buskirk writes about digital media for Wired.com on his blog, Listening Post. The record industry may be struggling, but in 2002, Dan Kennedy was pretty excited to leave the world of advertising and move to a major record label. His rock dreams didn't quite match his office life as director of creative development, coming up with ad campaigns for bands. His record industry career ended when he was laid off. He's written a funny memoir about that period called Rock On, an Office Power Ballad. He's also the author of the book Loser Goes First and is a contributor to McSweeney's. Dan Kennedy, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start from a reading from Rock On.
This is called I'm Paid to Write Love Notes to Phil Collins. Before we get to the first big assignment at the new, intense, high-profile rock and roll job, let me first admit that there is a delusion I have apparently quietly indulged since, say, age 30, and it's this, that I am still as cool as I was when I was 17. Inside the heart and head, a sort of suspended animation, a never-quite-acknowledged freezing of time. Unmonitored, this is how the tragedy of uncles who still get high happens. And now, having taken a full-time job working on the marketing and advertising of bands, somehow this delusion is raging in a very bad way. In the days leading up to the job, I've spent a lot of time laying on my couch, listening to my iPod and daydreaming about how I'm basically going to be paid to be some sort of intense, uber rock and roll person who is marketing loud, fierce, developing bands that are not yet registering on the radar of the so-called normal run-of-the-mill adults in the mainstream. Those were great, powerful, and beautiful moments of delusion, mostly because I had not yet sat down and faced this first big assignment, to write an inspirational and congratulatory ad campaign that celebrates 25 years of heartwarming love songs from Phil Collins. I've been told that one of the ever-changing co-presidents of the company wants to make sure I understand that my ad campaign is going to be targeted largely to females 40 to 50 plus years of age, so I need to be writing in that voice. The first thing I do is pace around the temporary office they've got me in, wondering how the hell I'm going to do this. I start trying to write some headlines that I think 40 to 50-something-year-old women can relate to. For some reason, they all sound like those Hallmark greeting cards that aren't really for any occasion in particular. Like, they're usually filed under a section called Just Because or Friend. The headlines go like this. Remember the first time you heard that special voice? Here's to the voice that taught us about love. Who was really your first love? In a quiet panic, I cut those headlines and I jump to adjectives like biggest selling, chart conquering, platinum smash, and then I land on the word hero. Yes, he's a hero. Okay, maybe not a hero, I think to myself.
And that's Dan Kennedy reading a section from his new memoir, Rock On, about doing marketing and advertising campaigns for Atlantic Records. Dan Kennedy, that was a great reading.
So
what are some of the ideas you did come up with for that Phil Collins campaign?
Well, you know, like I said, I kind of just entered this really strange, you know, area of my writing talent that I didn't know I had, which was to write these extremely emotionally vague notions about love and who taught you about love. And the clash of that, you know, to what I thought I would be doing, that was really day one on what I had convinced myself was going to be sort of like the front lines of the fierce rock and roll storm where, you know, I would be keeping it real, quote unquote. and I sort of fancied myself being this cross between like a really normal, you know, finally a normal, respectable person who, you know, went to an office and then home to loved ones each day and then back to an office and then home to a loved one. And I thought, oh, I'm finally going to fit in. But I also thought there will also be this kind of, you know, Henry Rollins-like quality about me suddenly that, you know, finds me just very, very dialed in and very, you know, not like the other 35-year-olds. And so to have day one sort of be, you know, trying to capture the voice of a 50-year-old woman, and I might mention being like chillingly good at doing it, was a little bit of a weird feeling. And so all the ideas I came up with were kind of like, you know, exactly those ones like remember love, you know, and, you know, wouldn't you like a little more love in your week and things like this. And I was just like, wow, this is odd. I'm really tapped into this, this experience of being, you know, a 50-year-old female, really right here on the front lines of rock and roll, aren't I?
See, that's one of the scary things, to think that there is a generic 50-year-old female that anybody could, who's, there isn't one.
There really isn't one, but if you work in marketing long enough, people convince you that there is, you know, it's sort of a cross between like a General Foods International Coffees and, you know, and a Hallmark card, you know, that would be sort of the tone, I think. But, you know, in the end, the ad that they ended up going with was simply a picture of Phil Collins' face and the number 25.
Because it was his 25th anniversary of
his
recording
simply,
career.
Yeah, and very simply they just said, oh, we're just going to use a picture of his face and the number 25. And at first I was kind of, you know, creatively outraged. I was like, why am I even here? This is all such a sham. Like, there's no writing craft in that. And then, of course, when I opened my mouth, what I heard myself say was, oh, that'll be nice. You know, that'll be an elegant way to go. Good, good.
At the beginning of that section, you talk about indulging the delusion that you're still as cool as you were when you were 17. And that's a delusion that I think many, many people inside and outside the record industry indulge in, if you ever thought you were cool to begin with. And I guess, like, did working in the inside of the record industry and seeing the bands and seeing the execs and writing directly to the fans make you rethink the whole meaning of the word cool anyway?
Yes. I mean, it was very much sort of a scared straight experience. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I would imagine for a normal developmental, you know, sort of thing that you would go through as a 35-year-old male, maybe you would gradually start realizing you're not cool and you'd start breaking it to yourself gently. But, you know, when you're in the recording studio with an all-female punk rock band who are all like 22 years old, you realize very quickly, like, oh, I'm kind of like the dad here. I'm kind of like the weird neighbor who, you know, doesn't know what's cool, who's using slightly wrong terminology, you know. I think that was the day it happened when I was, you know, recording PSAs with the Donnas from San Francisco, this great punk rock, sort of guitar rock, all-female band, very, very cool and very hip. And, you know, I was sort of standing there in, like, leather shoes and a gray sweater and slacks and, like, trying to convince them I was cool, you know, and I just thought, oh, gosh, you know, something has happened since 1986, and it's not good.
Yeah, but exactly at what moment were you cool? Because your first book is a memoir about being a loser. So where was exactly the time that you were cool?
Well, for a minute, I thought being on Fresh Air would go to my head, you know, like it'd be a bad thing. Feeling very well adjusted now. I don't, you know, I think I was cool briefly, and, you know, if I had to be pressed and really honest, I was probably cool briefly in 1985, You know, that doesn't sound like the most boastful, confident thing. If I walked into a cocktail party, I might not open with that remark about myself. But, you know, yeah, honestly, I was probably briefly cool in the junior and senior year of high school for me.
Do you start to think about popular culture as always being about overthrowing what came before?
I think to some degree, and you also start becoming one of those people. Like I started becoming very afraid that I was going to be that, you know, that guy who's like, hasn't been a decent record made since Sticky Fingers, you know, sort of a Simpsons character of yourself.
Yeah,
but you never quite wanted to be that person, and of course. Yeah, you do slowly start to become this person going, oh, it's kind of all been done before. Like I think that's why I started, you know, just getting way more into books really during that period.
What were some of the moments when the corporate setting and the music it was selling and promoting were most at odds?
You know, there's a scene in the book where I talk about being in a meeting where we find out that a song by Jewel, which is all about not selling out, it's a great song. You know, it's about following your heart and sort of staying true to yourself in this culture that is trying to always bombard you with advertising and media and different messages. But we were in this meeting finding out that we were going to license it in a like $120 million ad campaign for a razor for women, you know, and that was definitely ironic. I mean, I definitely remember looking around the room thinking, we're not supposed to say this is ironic, right? Are we supposed to, this song's all about not selling out, yet we're gonna, okay, I'm not clear on this, but I'll just keep my glasses on and look intelligent.
What's one of the ad campaigns or, you know, TV commercials that you came up with that you really liked?
I really liked, you know, I came up with a commercial for Fat Joe. He's this rapper from the South Bronx, and I shot this TV commercial with Fat Joe that I thought came out particularly good. I think I have a special sort of spot in my heart for that commercial.
What was the commercial? What did you do?
I see where you're going. You really want to know the extent of the ideas I came up with. Here's where it gets particularly humiliating. Well, the big idea there, as I put it in my treatment, was that Fat Joe would be in the quote-unquote panoramic prime Manhattan real estate, looking like a hip-hop overlord in control of the scene. Camera would track through the surroundings, push up to the desk, and Joe would lean into the light and simply say the word loyalty, which was the name of the new album. And this, you know, first I have to say that I wrote this treatment sort of like really over the top. And I wrote it over the top just because I thought they'll never go for this. It's kind of crazy. And I also think I was kind of overcompensating for the fact that I'm just your really normal average guy, you know, from the suburbs. And the worst thing happened is that, you know, my boss, Valerie, came into my office and was just all smiles going, he loves it. You know, we have to do it. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you know. But that was really the whole treatment. I mean, the whole script was, you know, we go into this sort of den of hip-hop righteousness. And there's a shadowy figure sitting at a huge desk. And as the camera moves toward that desk, he leans into the light. We see that it's Fat Joe. And he simply says the word loyalty.
My guest is Dan Kennedy, and he's written a memoir about working at a major record label, writing advertising and marketing campaigns, and his memoir is called Rock On, an Office Power Ballad. You have a great and very long light bulb joke in the book, and I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of it.
Excellent. Before we move on, a record business riddle. Question, how many of the likes of us does it take to change a light bulb? Answer. First of all, before we change anything, is the light bulb really burned out? Maybe we just need to breathe some life into it, repackage it. Maybe the light bulb could do a duet with somebody, Sheryl Crow, Tim McGraw, in hopes of getting some crossover appeal. Maybe it could be in a beer commercial. Maybe we could get it out on the road with a brighter light bulb. The other thing to think about is that this summer, Honda is rolling out a $100 million campaign for a new car aimed at 30-somethings who consider themselves adventurous and spontaneous, but can't really afford something like a luxury SUV. And it might be a perfect campaign to tie this light bulb into. At least it would be the perfect demographic in terms of age. Also, and this is just an idea, what if we found out what video games are being released in the third quarter and maybe pitched the idea of having our light bulb make an appearance in the video game at some certain level of completion? Like you get to a dark cave, let's say, if it's an adventure game, and if you have enough points, you can get the light bulb, and it would be our light bulb, obviously. And then it's easier to see in the cave. The other thing is this. Worst case scenario, the light bulb is, in fact, burned out. Is that really the end of the world? I mean, maybe that's actually of more value to us in the long run. Picture this for the voiceover. The light bulb is dead, but the legend lives on. Re-released, remastered, revealed. The light bulb in stores now. It almost makes more sense than taking the time to change it. Plus, if we can sell it without dealing with it, you know what I mean? No demands from it. No hotels, no road expense, no delays in the project from its end, etc. But like I said, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, just brainstorming. None of this is written in stone.
You quote, I think it was like the new chairman of the label that you work for saying something like, I don't tell people I'm in the record business. I tell people I'm in the business of delivering a lifestyle. Hooded sweatshirts and other merchandise. Merch that features various band logos, licensing soft drinks, everything. There's no limit to how this business will change and become a business of selling a way of living more than simply selling music. And I'm wondering, is that the direction you saw the music industry heading in? And if so, do you think it's a result of the fact that people are kind of giving up on actually selling music?
I mean, you know, it's funny. There's nothing wrong with music. You understand that it's not a tough time for music because I got really tired of, you know, basically guys who were making a ton of money and had offices the size of my entire apartment telling me that it's a really tough time for music. But if you go out in whatever city, you know, you're in tonight and you tell the 600 kids or the 100 kids or the 50 kids or the 2,000 kids lined up at the club to see their favorite band that this is a really tough time for music, they'll look at you like you're mental. You know, there's nothing wrong with music. The only thing that's wrong in the music business is, you know, basically the consumers and the fans caught on to the fact that, you know, they've kind of been getting a weird deal at $20 per CD for three good songs and some fillers type of thing. So in terms of, you know, what people said in that environment, like that quote about, you know, we're now going to be in the lifestyle business, one thing I learned is that I could probably really succeed in a corporate environment if I could just say incredibly vague things with a straight face. You know, like if you could just sort of be like a smart, casual, dressed beat poet, basically. You know, for someone who's making, you know, $7 or $8 million a year, or no, actually it was our new boss whose contract was $50 million a year, which just sounded like a joke amount. And then that speech he delivered about, you know, we're not in the music business, we're in the lifestyle business. I just thought, gosh, if I could say things that sort of random and vague, you know, while looking good, I would be so successful in this corporate environment. You know, if people just said like, you know, Dan, what do you see as the problem, you know, that's facing the music industry today? And I could say things like, I don't see that there's a problem as much as I understand that lifestyles are around us and that the air we breathe is the inspiration. So now more than ever, we're going to reach for the air. You know, but I always, you know, if you make enough money and you're in a big enough position, you say things that are just weird and vague and whimsical, and people are like, oh, yes, it's very much the emperor's new clothes. You know, it's just very much like, yes, that is brilliant, sir.
Dan Kennedy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure.
Dan Kennedy's new memoir is called Rock On, an Office Power Ballad. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.